Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 422 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm your East Coast host, Neil Tyra. Out on the West Coast, my good friend and buddy, Sam Malise. Sam, it's getting to be fall weather out here. The leaves are turning. It's a little crisp in the air. It's football weather. How about there in sunny Hollywood?
Good so far. We actually have a Jewish holiday coming up called Sukkot starting tomorrow night. And usually, historically, as soon as Sukkot hits, and I think the Jewish calendar is based on the, I believe, the solar system, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. And usually that holiday coincides with the weather changing. So let's see how this hypothesis works out. Is the weather suddenly going to change?
Yeah. Well, I know that we wanted to talk about some things that are near and dear to our heart this weekend. Tell us a little bit about what we're going to be touching upon, Sam.
All right, so today's episode is 5 hiring mistakes costing you millions. Neil, this is not a hyperbole, costing you millions. Really, if you know, the right hiring can make you millions and the wrong hiring could cost you millions. So the difference of a couple of million dollars either way. We want to try to give you the top 5 insights that we can share with you based on actual experience running law firms that we can share with you. I'm sure a lot of these you could be able to relate to. But there's a lot of good lessons to be shared here, and hopefully it will help you make millions of dollars from these hiring mistakes. Neil, point number one is something we talked about before, but it's definitely worth reiterating and talking about is hiring talkers instead of doers. Hiring talkers versus doers. This, I've noticed, Neil, is probably one of the biggest indicators of low performance and low sustainability hires versus long-term sustainable high ROI kind of people. People that are talkers talk and don't perform well, and people that are doers do and don't talk well. And what I found is people that are really, really good at their job interview and are really good at talking are actually underperform when they actually have to perform. So I look for indications to indicate, are they a talker or doer? If the role is for a talking role, so let's just say if it's for intake or sales or document collection or something, or a client success manager, something like that, then yes, by all means, you want to hire the talker because that's what you need. You need somebody to be able to, you know, communicate clearly and be able to have good, deep conversations with the client. However, if there's roles where it's required to get stuff done, such as like a director role, a manager role, you know, things behind the scenes, things like that. These, you need doers for those roles. And you want to make sure to be able to categorize that type of person and don't just base it based on what they say. Because again, if they're going to just tell you, if you just do it based on what they tell you, then you might fall for the trap of hiring the talker. And that's usually what happens. Spot that out early and put them in the right role. If you don't, then you're going to kind of regret that. Neil, what's your take on this?
Yeah, I think it's interesting, Sam, that I started putting this to a bit of a test based on, you know, some of the conversations we've had over the last few weeks. And I talked to several attorneys as of late about their hiring practices. And I can't tell you how many people said, oh, yeah, they really nailed the interview. And I thought to myself, huh, that sounds like a talker rather than a doer. And I said, well, what about nailing the interview impressed you? They said, oh, well, they were articulate. They seemed comfortable talking with me. There was no kind of dead space in the interview. It really flowed smoothly. And then when I followed up and said, well, what about their previous work and their previous acts that demonstrated to you that they would be able to do the job that you were interviewing them for? And they go, well, we really didn't talk about that. We just talked about, you know, their background and what they were looking for in the future by way of a job and where they thought they're going to be in 5 years. And I thought, man, this is setting yourself up for hiring a talker rather than a doer.
Yeah. And it usually doesn't turn out well, right? It's a dead end. Or maybe they just stay at their role and just doesn't go anywhere. So be on the lookout. We've shared little indicators of, you know, who are the talkers. Let me quickly go over these because I think it's pretty important to be on the lookout. Talkers end up usually having three signs. Number one is they talk about the past, things that they've done. and they usually fluff it up and they make it seem amazing. And you hear it, you're like, wow, great. Wow, sounds amazing. Second thing that they do is they talk about things that they're going to do. And I'm going to do this, and I'm also going to do this. Or sometimes it's like, you know, when you give them tasks, they're like, yeah, I'm going to do this too. I'm going to do this too. Instead of kind of the ones that are doers are kind of prioritizing, or sometimes they comment on it. Hey, maybe we shouldn't focus on this. They don't just try to assume that everything is just going to be done. And the third sign is people that extend the time. So that means the talkers have usually longer meetings, but I just say you schedule a 30-minute meeting and you notice that it's going beyond the 30 minutes. Those are like kind of telltale signs that you're probably dealing with a talker. And again, if the role is a talking role, by all means, those types of people should, you know, be talkers in those roles. But if they're in a doer role, they're showing you those three signs, then you might want to realign things.
Sam, does your viewpoint change on this if you're talking about hiring, say, VAs versus full-time staff members versus associate attorneys? Other than your caveat about those roles that do require gift of articulation, did your view change any in that respect?
Not at all. Not at all. No. So it doesn't matter where they're based or whether they're virtual or in-house or whatever that is. You just want to make sure that their skills or what they are, their traits aligns with their role, whether it be a virtual or not. It's a great question.
Well, the reason I ask is because some of the feedback I get is, well, that sounds great when you're talking about VAs, but if I need to hire an associate attorney, I'm going to be asking different sets of questions. I'm going to be looking for different things. And I wanted to get your view because I suspected that that's exactly what you were going to say, is that it doesn't really matter. We're talking about an associate attorney, a partner, a office administrator, a part-time employee, a receptionist, or VA. It doesn't matter. You're looking for people who can get the job done as opposed about talking about how they're going to get the job done.
Correct. And it's also, I think it comes down to knowing yourself. If you happen to be a talker, then you're more likely to need a doer. And if you're a doer, then you might potentially want to surround yourself with a couple of talkers. But what I've found in, you know, for me, I found more success, a lot more likely to find success in doers. And maybe in very specific roles, especially when it comes to intake and sales, then sure, you know what, I'll accept you as a talker and that will be able to thrive in that role. Let's go to point number two. Second hiring mistake costing millions is hiring for skills and not cultural fit. Neil, what's your take on this?
And to me, this is really important because as I mentioned in a previous episode, I was one time referred to as the country club manager. And I at first was disappointed to hear that. Criticism of myself, but later I came to embrace it because, in fact, I have discovered in all the folks that I have hired over the not just the legal career that I've had, but the four other careers that preceded me becoming an attorney, was that it's way more important to surround myself with people that are culturally similar or that I can work with. You know, it doesn't matter if the person is the greatest thing since sliced cheese, if they're a pain in the backside to work with and they're going to alienate everybody in the office and all your clients around you. Well, that's not a good fit. So it for me, it's way more important that I can relate to the person who I'm hiring and that I can, that I like being around them and I can enjoy working with them because, frankly, the rest of it can be taught or either taught or they have it or they don't have it.
Totally. And I totally agree with you, Neil. You got to enjoy working with that person. There's a lot of intangibles in work to make it work, right? Let's just say you're playing a basketball game. The experience and the enjoyment leads to your focus and your skills to be able to play a good game. So even if they have the right skills and they're great, but you don't feel good with them, then that lowers your performance and your focus. And instead of being in a positive expected value for them, for you to work with them. But if that brings you down, then overall, the expected value is actually less. So you got to think of kind of take a wholesome approach. And for me, it's all about sustainability. Do you imagine yourself working with this person for many years? If from the get-go, the answer is no, then it's just a matter of time when you're going to butt heads. And if that's the case, then it's better to pull the band-aid early. Not waste time, you know, investing time and effort to train somebody and go deep into a business with somebody. And then, you know, 5 months later, you have to call the band-aid, cut the band-aid, and just like, you know, efforts went wasted. So yes, totally aligned on you on this, Neil.
Yeah, I think it doesn't matter. You can have the best policies and procedures and standard operating practices in the world, but if you don't get along with the people that you work with, if they don't get along with your staff and the other members of your firm, then it's just a cultural misfit that's going to blow up at some point in time, regardless of what technical, you know, expertise and guardrails you have in place.
Love it. All right, let's go to point number three: overvaluing credentials over practical skills. Neil, somebody comes to you, they graduated from Harvard, and they worked at, you know, big law firm. Is that important for you, or is somebody who potentially worked in a relevant practice type with a very similar cultural background or, you know, culture of your law firm, which one matters more for you?
Well, for a person who themselves didn't graduate from a top tier law school, nor anywhere near the top of their class, I've always felt that it's the practical skills that somebody brings to the table that's far more important than the credentials. And I think actually this is something that is to a degree unique to attorneys, that the idea of the curriculum vitae, which I never really heard until, you know, I went to law school and people started, I said, isn't that really your resume? Everybody else in the world calls it your resume, but no, lawyers, we call it something different. Dependence upon the list of bullet items that are on the resume seems to be, or the overdependence seems to be, to a degree, unique to law firms. And that's a mistake, putting that much emphasis on there. Because look, we all know you can have top guy in the class that may not be the right person for your firm. And so you really want to look at practice schools. What have they done in real world situations? What are their demonstrative skills that they can actually demonstrate rather than talk about?
Sure. And usually the ones that are like higher tiered, they come from higher tiered schools and they go work in these corporate roles. From what I've heard from those types of people is that they take on a very specific, you know, one particular role in a big kind of big company that has a lot going on. And they don't get really hands-on, practical, real, raw experience that it takes to be able to be a well-rounded lawyer. Ultimately, the practical skills is tied to hands-on experience. And I'd rather work with somebody who's worked at a small law firm who has actual hands-on experience, you know, from being able to onboard a new client all the way through the information gathering, the writing up the demand letters and the discovery, all that work, those practical hands-on experience, it's where it's at, especially for, I think, most of our listeners are like kind of small law firm owners. You want to look for those types of people who have that kind of hands-on experience.
Yeah. And I think a lot of times if you're looking, now this particularly applies to bringing on legal staff. If you're looking to hire somebody who's dropping down from big law or mid law size law into a smaller practice, look, they've had resources and personnel accessible to them that you may not have in your firm. And so they've never had to do their own discovery. They've never had to respond to their own interrogatories from opposing counsel. And so you're not going to have the same hands-on skill set that somebody who's bubbled up from the bottom. For me, the ideal candidate in many cases is somebody who started as a intern and then stayed on with a small firm and did everything in that small firm and rose to a point where they now had a marketable set of legal skills. And now we're looking to maybe, you know, come into my practice where they're going to be doing something a little different, but challenging. They have real world skills, and that's much more important to me than where they graduated from.
Well said, Neil. All right, let's go to point number four. Fourth biggest hiring mistake is failing to define the role clearly. Neil, a lot of people just hire and just expect the person just come in, figure it out, and fill in the holes. But from your experience, we know that that doesn't work. Every law firm is different. So you got to clearly define exactly what you do, what the rest of the team is doing, and thus, this is where you fall into this big picture of the law firm.
I remember a firm owner said to me one time, said, well, I don't know what they're not giving me, but I know I'm not getting it. And I thought, well, you're the problem. You know, you don't know what you're asking them to do. You don't know what their role is. You can't clearly define what it is that you're expecting them to produce. And so, you know, hoping that that magically appears just as the process of having been brought onto your team, it's just a fool's errand. It's just not going to happen. And it's going to go tie nicely with our next point here, too, about having to bring that person on board properly. But you have to have a defined role and function. And people not only have to know what that role and function is, they have to know where that fits in into the overall process that your law firm addresses or produces. So they have to see the big picture as well.
Great point. What I've seen, Neil, is that people require two things. One is ownership of their role. Two, something to look forward to. Something to look forward to. Ownership means that this is your world, your responsibility. If there is a disparity or there's a divided ownership and the people don't feel like it's theirs, their baby to take care of, then they're just going to assume that the other person is just taking care of it. And this happens all the time. This is probably one of the biggest inefficiencies in any size of law firm, especially the bigger that it gets, you know, right? There's no ownership. Oh, I think that person's supposed to do it. And at the end, the boss checks in and checks on and it's like, who did it? It's like, well, I thought they were supposed to. And then the other person is like, no, I thought you were supposed to. And then at the end, got nothing done. So make sure that the ownership is clearly defined. You add a label. Hey, this goal that we're trying to achieve, this is your responsibility. Okay. Make sure you do that very specifically. And two, something to look forward to. If you just, you know, bring somebody on and you think that they're just going to be on the hamster wheel for you to just do things for you 40 hours a week, for the next 12 months, it's a dead end. It's a dead end for them because people just inherently want something to look forward to. And something I noticed by myself, Neil, is when I don't have something to look forward to, whether it be a goal or a vacation or a trip, something to look forward to, then life just becomes meaningless. And then it's just a matter of time where you kind of get burnt out and you're like, and you start questioning things, what is this for? And you don't realize that you actually start self-sabotaging yourself and your work. You just don't realize why that is. And then later you realize maybe, you know, I didn't have anything to look forward to. So what I try to do is programmatically create incentives or something that people could grow to in every role. You know, there's no role that we have that doesn't have some kind of incentive or something to grow to. And that drives people. And that gives people a reason to, you know, wake up in the morning and try to achieve that goal. And if they achieve that goal, great. Let's go to the next level and next level. And the winners that I've seen, Neil, thrive and love it. They want it. What's my goal? Where should I go to grow to? The ones who kind of fight it off are the lazy people. And those are the ones that you want to eventually filter through.
There's the thing. You also have to have ownership of your vision. They have to feel a part of it. You know, it's not just, you know, the job title and, you know, what's the next step up, but the overall vision of what you're trying to accomplish as a law firm. They have to feel like they're part of that vision. They're part of that solution.
Yep, spot on. Now let's go to point number five, which is not setting up the onboarding process properly. Onboarding, we've talked about this before. Again, when somebody joins, they're not clear exactly what they should do, how they should get onboarded, what tools are you using, who should I be communicating with, what are my resources, who are my resources, all that stuff. And it requires a really good, clear, standard operating procedure that we talked about multiple times throughout the show. And you can't just let people figure things out. It's up to you to clarify those terms and those instructions that people need to go through as they get onboarded. Neil, what's your take?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, very true. And I was thinking about this the other day because you had talked about a couple of the tools that you were using. And I don't know if social media picked up on my thought patterns, but I started getting a lot of social media ads for a product called Scribe, which a platform that I've been paying a lot of attention to. So our listeners, if they want to kind of look at a tool that might help you with developing those procedures, you might want to look at Scribe. But one of the things I was thinking back on, back in the days when I worked in the IT world, our onboarding process, there were formal review periods. And whether you go to that perspective or not is up to you. But they did involve discrete objectives for every 30, 60, or 90 days, or sometimes for some job categories, there were longer timeframes. And I think we need to do that as attorneys, as law firms. We need to define, and look, it doesn't have to be in excruciating detail, but there should be a series of bullet points that describe what you expect that individual to be able to do and accomplish after, say, 30 days, after 60 days, 90 days. It should show a graduating level of authority and expertise with each successive iteration of accomplishment. So it's important to have that onboarding process laid out in a structured way, just not making it up on the fly.
Yeah. Neil, I'm going to share three pointers and I'm going to end off with a bang because I'm going to share with you my last onboarding, exactly what I did and the top takeaways. I'm going to summarize the onboarding that I just recently did. So the first tool that I'm going to put on people's radar is a 30, 60, 90 day plan. Essentially, it just comes down to, you know, your, as you onboard, especially when you need those key roles, you know, the directors, the new partner, lawyer, whatever, you know, those kind of key roles, you want to ask them then within the first 2 weeks to provide you a 30, 60, 90 plan based on what they see. That essentially means, what are you going to be doing the first 30, 60, 90 days? And it's a plan that they come up with that you want to hold them accountable to. And after 90 days, you know, from based on this 90-day plan that you came up with, how much of that did you perform? People are not going to go through everything, but at the very least, 50% of that should be, you know, completed. But if you see that they put down something on paper, then after the 90 days, they're nowhere near to that. But guess what? That 90 days is a pretty good indication of what the next 100, how many days is going to look like. And it's a very good way to evaluate the performance. So definitely kind of required for us, you know, right away, our mind goes through, let's getting a 30, 60, 90 plan. And then from there, evaluating how things are going to go. Number two, Neil, you mentioned it, Scribe, scribehow.com. We mentioned it in one of our previous podcasts. And at the time, when I mentioned, I knew about it. I just didn't use it. Neil, we signed up for a couple of weeks ago. We have so much training. We actually have a dedicated person just for training. So I signed up for an account. I believe it was like 30, 40 bucks a month. Not expensive, well worth it. If you're considering doing it, you know, I wouldn't overthink it. I would just sign up for a month and try it out. But it basically allows you to create really amazing SOPs and instructions for your team. It basically tracks your you click record. It's like a Chrome plugin. And automatically, it's able to record the instructions of as you're doing things around your computer. Especially if it's like something that has to be done on a computer, like filing something. So all those transactional lawyers will get a really kick out of scribehow.com. The third tool that we actually just recently signed up for is synthesia.io, synthesia.io.com. It's a very popular text to video tool. This is like SOP and onboarding on crack, on steroids. You don't need, you know, a lot of people may not need it, but people that are like kind of geeky about onboarding and training, then definitely worth looking into. We signed up for it. And what we're doing, Neil, is returning our written SOPs into an engaging video into kind of onboarding and training, right? We onboard a lot of intakers and document collectors to our team, like I would say half a dozen per week, every single week consistently. So we want to make it engaging as good as possible, right? We just don't want to give people just a set of instructions and just get them through it. We want to improve that. So we're using Synthesia to turn into, again, engaging videos. Last thing that I'll share, Neil, is a summary of my onboarding. I recently just launched my fifth law firm, which is pretty exciting. And we hired our first hire as a director. So just somebody who's basically going to build everything from the ground up, using our existing resources and SOPs and teams and everything that we already have. So it should be a pretty easy law firm to launch. One cool thing that I did was, since I've created so many law firms, all I did was I consolidated my checklist of things that I need to be able to create a law firm. Very consolidated amazing list. I'm actually going to be sharing this list instead of Lawyer Club, hopefully this week, if not the following week. If you haven't joined our free community, just go to joinlawyerclub.com. I'll be posting it there so you'll be able to grab it. So that's the first kind of resource that I'm giving away. Second is, after I did my 2-hour onboarding in person to this director to get them onboarded to come and create a law firm from scratch, I, on a whiteboard, I basically summarized the gist of the onboarding that I said, this is it. This is, listen, this is your focus going forward. So even if I don't talk to you for the next couple of weeks, come back to this whiteboard and they'll be sitting here at this office. So you to get you back on track. So it's a couple of pointers. Number one is the team building. For us, the infrastructure, it's a lot of infrastructure building. So getting very clear on the team that we would like to build. So I created a Google Sheet of basically the roles that we should have. I tapped into one of my other directors to help me with this also. And something that was important for us that I realized is like the order of hiring. So we got clear on that. But again, using a Google Sheet, we laid out who we should hire and then we just moved around the rows so we know exactly who to hire. And a lot of those hires were kind of concurrently. So let's just say by week two, we should hire these for these two or three positions. Then by week four, hire these certain positions. So that was kind of key. Second, 30, 60, 90 day plan. I need that. I'm actually getting that later today, which is pretty exciting. And the third is fast execution concurrently. That's what I called it. I basically summarized everything that we're going to be doing as fast execution concurrently. That's what I need from you. Your pace matters. Execute. You know, don't run on anything and do it concurrently. So I added some bullet points under it. And I'm like actually looking at the screenshot right now. It says, don't wait on anybody or anything, including me. So you don't need my permission. You know what the objective is. Just get it moving forward. Two, tap into existing team and resources. If you already have some resources, then you should obviously open all that up to them. That should be for us. A lot of that is just Google Sheets and links. So, you know, during that time, I shared that all that with them. And third is no limit, unlimited budget. And I basically opened the door. Here's my credit cards. Go take a crack at it. And it's been 2 weeks. I did this 2 weeks ago. Today, we're doing a catch-up call. And from the email that he sent us last Friday, I could see the progress that he's made. And I think the fact that I put him in the right frame of mindset, fast execution concurrently, give him all the resources, connect him to all the right people, I think it may have been my best onboarding that I've ever done. I'm super proud of it.
Yeah, it sounds like it has great potential.
Yeah, and I'm excited. Might be probably our fastest growing and most successful law firm that is literally being budding right now. So it's pretty exciting. Neil, we'll add one more pointer as a bonus.
Okay.
Not tracking performance metrics from day one. All right. At least being very clear on what the main KPI is for every role, for every person that you hire. So, you know, you got to know what that is for you. A lot of times it could be number of clients that you sign up or revenue potentially, or maybe building out your team to a certain number or something like that. But whatever that is, try to come up with a numeric number per month or per quarter. We usually like per month. Consistent progress that you could tie everybody's role to. Kind of again, standard, something to really do, and something not to be missed. All right. So to summarize, it's been a pretty value-packed episode. Yeah. Number one, don't hire talkers, hire doers. Number two, make sure the person is culturally fit. Make sure that you actually enjoy working with the person or else it's not sustainable. Number three, look for practical skills and not just don't put too much weight on their credentials. Number four, clearly define their role. Get very specific exactly what they need to accomplish. And number five, make your onboarding smooth and easy and descriptive so then people know exactly what they have to accomplish. All right. If this looks good on YouTube, please let us know. If you watch this on YouTube, just let us know. So again, so we're trying this out. I'm also, Neil, something that I realized I'm going to do is I'm going to give it 2 weeks, see how this podcast performed compared to our other recordings. And then based on that, make the assumptions to see which tool makes sense. So we'll see how that goes. All right. Yeah. We'll see you in the next episode. Let's actually share the next episode.
Don't forget to share it with one person.
Yes, Neil. Good point. Share this episode with one person that we know these episodes are value packed. By you sharing it, you add value to their life. They'll appreciate it. Oh, somehow the karma will come back to you. And also bring us good karma too. We appreciate you. Next episode, the title is Why Are the Best Lawyers Not Always the Most Successful? Pretty good topic. We'll see you in the next episode.
Take care.
Thanks for listening to The Law Entrepreneur. If you found value in the show, please rate, review, and subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you're listening. And don't forget to share the episode with a friend. It could help transform their life. To get access to a treasure trove of exclusive free resources for lawyers, go to joinlawyerclub.com. Again, that's joinlawyerclub.com. We'll see you on the next episode.